Hello, I'm Munkan McGann, and you're very welcome to the Big Adventure podcast.
The Big Adventure is a series for people willing to truly immerse themselves in the world around them, to sip tea with Bedouins or even Tory Islanders, to experience life to the max, diving into it, skiing down it, clambering up it with picks and shovels in the face of a force 10 gale. Each week, we'll hunt out some of the bravest, most foolhardy adventurers to hear their stories, to vicariously taste their thrills. Over the next 6 weeks, I'll be bringing you sea kayaking, paragliding, whale hunting, talking to people who've scaled the Eiger, who've lived with pygmies in Africa and kayaked down the Shannon. This week, I want to focus on people whose jobs actually involve full-on, far-out adventure travel. Martina Tyrrell is an environmental anthropologist studying Inuit hunters in the Canadian Arctic. Her primary focus is on hunters of beluga whale and polar bears. What a job, Martina. I can just imagine you in school and thinking, I want a job where I can chase whales, where I can chase seals. How do you get that?
I never ever thought that when I was at school. I ended up, I went to the Arctic completely by accident, and it was just a series of serendipitous events that got me there. I was working in Maynooth at the time in the anthropology department there, and decided that I wanted to strike out and do something different. And I just did a random search on the internet for volunteer work, and ended up going to Arviad, which is an Inuit community on the northwest coast of Hudson Bay. Spent a year there working as a volunteer at an elementary school. And then from that, got into Arctic anthropology, went away to Aberdeen, did my PhD there, and that was it. And found myself there.
I'm lucky. I end up with a real-life kind of Arctic hunter in the studio. Also with me in studio is John Murray, whose company Crossing the Line Films explores the furthest reaches of the world, from the Arctic to the Antarctic, the Sahara to the Amazon. He goes where few others dare to venture. John, your company has sailors in it, it has divers, it has mountaineers. Again, how do you end up owning a little company with it's like Cousteau or something, with its own, you know, mini expeditionists?
Well, you're absolutely right. You mentioned Cousteau. I blame him and Enid Blyton.
Really?
I used to be, as a child, obsessed with sort of lost valleys and mountains and, you know, far off seas. And the one person who used to strike me all the time was Jacques Cousteau on the television. I just looked at him and I thought, he has the life. He has a big ship with helicopters. He dives. He has submarines. He flies around islands. And he seems to have the most wonderful life. So I thought, well, that's probably a good way to go down. So I ended up doing marine biology or zoology in college. And I just waited for the helicopters and the cameras and everything else to appear. And they never quite appeared. We were studying sort of intertidal mudflats and starfish digestive enzymes. So eventually I did my degree. But after that, I decided to take some time out and see what I would do. And I was always attracted to the sort of idea of telling stories from these wild and remote places. So I did a year around the world and worked on the Great Barrier Reef for a while, and then came back and fortuitously started working RTE, and was always interested in making films, so it sort of happened from there.
And this was Ireland in the 70s. You know, there really weren't opportunities. If you had a dream, you were basically stood upon. But somehow, you just thought there was a way of having a career where you could travel the world, go to extreme places and tell stories?
Yes, I suppose a lot of this is in your head, it's in your imagination, and I suppose you know a lot of adventure is in the head, and when a lot of people travel by reading wonderful books about places they would like to go and maybe don't ever get there. So I suppose I had the opportunity once I left college to actually go out for a year or two and experience some of these places in a way that a lot of people do. In some ways I was lucky. I ended up working on an excavation of a ship on the Great Barrier Reef, which was a step beyond, you know, maybe normal travel that you might do in a year break or a year gap from college. And that sort of made me realize that really you could actually end up working in these environments, doing something that you felt had some value, and at the same time experiencing, you know, what these environments had to offer.
So, Martina, there was some leap with you from studying anthropology in Maynooth to tasting life in the Arctic, also tasting life in Japan. Mm-hmm. But where does that leap go to decide, I want to immerse myself in Inuit culture?
Yeah, I love finding out about people, especially, you know, people who are very different to me and whose culture is very different to my own. And looking at sort of environmental issues. So I've managed in my job as an environmental anthropologist to blend all these things together in the Arctic. And what I did, my as one of our main methodologies in anthropology is participant observation, and the idea behind that is that you, in order to learn about people, you actually participate in their culture. And I wanted to find out how people, how Inuit learn about the sea, the skills they need to travel and work and hunt on the sea in the summertime and in the wintertime when it's ice, and the animals that they encounter at sea, seals, whales, polar bears, and how they interact with those animals, the relationships they have with those animals, and then the way they think about those animals, which is a very different way to how we would think about animals. And in order to do that, I had to do those things with people. So I went out, I learned how to hunt, I learned how to travel on, how to use boats, how to use skidoos and quad bikes. And I just immersed myself in the community, which I continue to do every time I go back, and just become as involved in life as possible. And it's fantastic. It's great fun.
It's a unique job to be actually paid, that your role
is... Someone pays me. That's the best thing.
To go out hunting. But it's also a particularly dangerous job in times,
yeah.
Is it?
It can be quite dangerous at times, particularly in wintertime and particularly towards the end of winter, going out on the floe edge. And you're talking about at the end of winter, the floe edge can be 2 or 3 miles from the village. So you go onto the sea and you're travelling on the sea ice, and at the edge where the edge of the ice meets the water, the ice can be very thin. But that's where the best seal hunting is.
Right.
So it can be dangerous, and you know, those are things that I tend not to tell my family until, you know, long after I've come home, and they think I, you know, they imagine I'm safe out there.
How do you know how thin the ice is or how thick?
I trust the hunters. I have to trust the hunters.
How do they know?
Long-term experience, just immersing themselves, they're attuned to the environment just because they're living. A lot of accidents do happen, but people are very attuned to the environment. Just to give you an example, I was going to the floe edge one day with a hunter that I spent a lot of time with, and we went on, he was on a skidoo, and I was in the sled behind, he was pulling me along, and we went to the floe edge, and then he said, oh, let's go over there, and he sort of pointed in another direction. But instead of going directly to, we were going to some pressure ice, but instead of going directly to it, we went on this sort of quite long circuitous route to get to it.
Right.
And when we got there, we climbed up on the ice, and I said to him, you know, why do we do that? And he said, well, look down there. And from sort of the vantage point of being on this pressure ice, we looked down and we could see that where if we had come straight across, we would have come over a patch of what looked like quite grey ice.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, it was no ice at all. It was open water that just had a thin film of snow on top. I wouldn't have known. I would have gone straight through it and sunk to the bottom of the sea.
Right.
But he knew, he could see that, you know, to go around it. So it's, I have to trust the hunters I'm with a
but
lot.
But as you're saying, that isn't a guaranteed way of doing it, because they sometimes get it
wrong.
Yes. If the light conditions are wrong, if they misread the ice.
Yeah.
So basically, every time you go out there, you're putting yourself at enormous risk.
I am, but then my attitude is, I could get killed crossing the road here in Ireland.
Right. It still doesn't explain why you do it.
I love it. I love the outdoors. I love Inuit, you know, the people I work with, the Inuit people are so much fun, so easygoing, so laid back. The hunters that I work with have such a vast knowledge of the land and the sea and the animals. And it's just, it's a great life. And it's a very slow life as well. It's very slow. I mean, there are days and days and days when nothing happens. And also when you're going hunting, you can spend hours and hours and hours just waiting in a boat or waiting at the floe edge. And it's so relaxing and just, it's quietness. It's beautiful.
John, do you know this place at all? Have you been to the Arctic ever?
I've been many times. We've done, I think, 8 films in polar regions, 3 in the Antarctic and 5 in the Arctic. So
Right. We've
been going to and from the Arctic for quite a number of years.
Has it required risk? Has it required danger?
It's very cold at that time of the year. It's minus 40. Yes, you can get lost in a blizzard very easily. You know, visibility can go down to 2 meters if you're not careful. You go to the toilet from your tent, you can get lost 6 feet from your tent. So you do have to be extremely careful. Is it particularly risky? You know, it depends. If you're unlucky, you can, you know.
So blizzards is a possible danger, as you say. What else? Polar bears? Are there polar bears there?
There are polar bears there. Not so many in the particular area we're in, so we don't have particular issues with them.
And you just think overall it's worth it? I mean, your family, you're leaving them back home, you're going off on this thing. Does that risk element get to you?
Well, obviously, that's part of the attraction, and it's part of the spice of life is to experience these places and feel you're off the beaten track, and that, you know, I think risk adds interest to life, and life is very dull if there isn't an element of risk in it. It makes it worth living, really, I find.
You talk so lightly about this. Like, do you think you might have become immune to danger at this stage? You really are putting yourself, you both are putting yourselves out there. You're just willing to do it, John. You have children at home, but it's...
Well, one always thinks that until something very, very unpleasant happens. We were on we've just come back from 2 months filming in the Himalaya, following a family who every year cross the Himalaya with their yaks. And one blithely thinks about risk, yes, no problem. But then we were filming on a particularly narrow path. This is just 4 or 5 weeks ago, and we had been filming with the tripod set up, and then we moved about 10 yards, and about 10 seconds later, this enormous rock came down right where we were standing 10 minutes previously. So, you know, you forget about these things shortly afterwards, but, you know, there are elements of risk. For sure. But as Martina said, you can easily get knocked down on the dual carriageway outside you.
Yeah.
RTE, if we lurch out of this interview.
And I can see exactly. I can see the way that there is a thrill involved. But particularly for people who go on expeditions just for the fun of it is another thing. But because the two of you are doing it as a career, because you could have a nice civil servant job at home and earn your money from there, it just seems particularly interesting that one would do something that almost every day involves incredible adventure, but obviously real risk. Martina, have you had to face death? Have you been in Dyson?
I haven't. I went on one trip to the tree line where, you know, I went with the family and we were supposed to go for about 10 days by skidoo, and everything that could go wrong did go wrong. And luckily we got back home, you know, all of us intact. But it was one of those things where on the trip we lost everything. We lost our rifles, we lost our ice auger, we lost...
Your what? Your ice?
An ice auger to drill through the ice to fish. Right. And we had the dad of the family had he'd killed a caribou and butchered it and attached it to the back of the sled.
Nice.
Somehow along the way the caribou fell off, so we lost that. So we had no food. We had some food, but not a whole lot. And then,
wait, how do you lose these things?
I don't know.
You don't know.
They just fell off. We hadn't tied things to the sled tightly enough.
Is the sled being pulled by dogs or a skidoo?
The sled is being pulled by skidoo.
Right. Does anyone pull with dogs anymore?
Oh, yes. Yeah. Right. Yeah, there's a lot of... And in fact, polar bear sport hunting, trophy hunts, so these rich guys who come up north to hunt polar bears, that by law, that has to be done by dog team.
Okay.
Yeah, so it's by sled. But yeah, we lost everything. And then on the way home, the skidoo broke 2 or 3 times and the sled actually broke in half. And something that really amazes me about Inuit is not only the resilience and the almost, they're very stoic. And I can imagine, you know, if it was my family and everything was going wrong, there'd be a lot of cursing
exactly,
going on.
Exactly, exactly.
Nothing was said, you know, we just got down to it, did what had to be done, fixed it. We had to, you know, sleep overnight just in the middle of nowhere with no water, with nothing. And things were just fixed. You know, the skidoo, the part of the skidoo that was broken was fixed with a piece of rope. Mm. Luckily, we were close enough to the tree line that the dad went off on the skidoo on his own. Hacked down a tree and brought that back and fixed the sled with the trunk of a very thin birch tree. And,
and what was the rifle there for? What was that, to protect you, or what was it?
We could have encountered tundra grizzly bears, but we didn't. Right. But the rifle was mostly for hunting caribou. But
okay.
you would never. I mean, I don't know, but you. I mean, would you go out in the north without having a rifle with you? Certainly. I would always bring a rifle along with polar bears in mind.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I don't know about you.
Usually with people who have guns. Yeah. Not that I'm any use.
Guns are always handy.
Well, I have a mildly amusing story. We were up in the Arctic last summer, part of this, you know, Franklin search, and I was given a gun because I was, for some reason, was in a tent 20 yards away from the other guys who were all experienced hunters and northern men. So I was given a rifle, you know, anything moves that you don't like, shoot this. So I thought, fine. And knowing that I had a notion of using it. But anyway, and then, so following day, they were out hunting caribou. And so they took my rifle to hunt the caribou. They were about 50 yards from the caribou and they started shooting at the caribou. Now, 9 shells later, the caribou was still sitting there eating grass and looking at them. The sight was off, and they did hit him a few times, but didn't hit him exactly where they should have hit him. So then he turns and ambles off with 4 bullets in him. And I was totally shocked. So I was thinking, what chance have I of bringing down a polar bear that's coming at me at 30 miles an hour with one shot?
My God.
Yeah, well, that was one of my jobs this summer. I spent a lot of time with one particular hunter, Frank, and the place where he set his fishing nets to catch Arctic char was also where people haul up beluga whales to butcher them once they've been killed. And so because you've got all these beluga whale carcasses along this particular reef, polar bears love it, and you've got polar bears coming there all the time to feast on the beluga whales. And so my job during the summer, when I would go with Frank to his fishing nets, I was on guard duty, and I just had to stand while Frank went out and cleaned his nets of seaweed and took his fish in. I just had to stand there looking for polar bears, and if there was a bear, which on occasion there was, I would just, you know, keep an eye on the bear, and if the bear came any closer, let Frank know so we could make a hasty retreat from the beach.
So your defence mechanism was to look at the polar bear.
Maybe I was his defence mechanism.
He was sort of a decoy.
Yeah.
Right. John, you've got a film coming up, The Northeast Passage, this week, in fact, this Thursday at 10:15 on RT. Will that give a sense of any element, of any particular element of Arctic life, or is it based on the sea?
It's the story of a crew and their boat north about. It's an Irish boat and an Irish crew who completed basically the first east-west polar circumnavigation of the Arctic. Mm. They did the Northwest Passage across the top of Canada in 2001, and this is them completing this polar circumnavigation across the top of Russia.
The first time I saw one of your programmes, you were, I think, somewhere up the Himalayas. In fact, it was Dermot Summers walking up the Himalayas. I saw him hiking up the hill, and then suddenly hiking up a mountain, quite a steep, you know, mountain peak. And suddenly I realised the camera was on another peak, you know, miles away, filming him. And it was a spectacular shot. But then it dawned on me, someone had to be over on that other peak. Someone had to walk the whole way over to that other peak just to take the shot of Dermot walking up a mountain. That was you, was it? And you were, presumably, it wasn't just you. It was you with a tripod, you with a camera. So your work not only requires going to these places, it requires, you know, a huge amount of lifting things, of carrying things, of organisation.
It does to a certain extent. And you, when you're visiting these spectacular places, we like to try and bring the best gear we can, which usually means bigger kit. There are a lot of small cameras today, as everybody knows, which are amazing quality given the size of them. And you're always torn. Do you bring the small cameras, easy to use, light to carry, or do you try and bring the biggest, best quality camera that you can get your hands on? And we have tended to go with the latter. And yes, it is a pain in the neck carrying, you know, literally and every other way, to carry the gear around the place, and years of hauling them up hills hasn't done me any good. But at the end of the day, you figure, I'm only going to be here once, and if I go back and think, oh, why didn't we bring the bigger camera, which would have given us the better quality, you might regret it afterwards. So now we shoot in high definition, which is, you know, the latest video format, and will be the format of years to come. Mm-hmm. And again, they're big cameras, but when you come back, it's worth the effort, you know. The quality is there, the sharpness is there, you capture the mood and, you know, the detail. One of the things I like about the job I have is that we are working in these environments and with these people. So in some ways, I don't feel you're going in on a holiday or a trip, you know, a jolly for yourself, that you are actually hopefully showing the world their culture and what extraordinary people they are. So on one level, that's rewarding. But as you say, you go into a traditional culture and you bring a lot of the paraphernalia of Western culture with you. Cameras, you're taking stills all the time, you're shooting video of them at their intimate moments, or you try. And so there is a bit of a, you do feel awkward at times, being sort of bedecked in you know, Western 21st century technology, yet at the same time you're trying to feature what is a very traditional technology that you are saying is obviously very worthy of exposure and people should learn from that. So yes, I do find myself all the time torn, you know.
This is The Big Adventure on RT Radio 1. I'm Moncon McGann. I'm joined in studio by anthropologist Martina Tyrrell, now spending much of her life hunting whales in the Arctic. I'm also with John Murray, a cinematographer who specialises in documenting rare and remote cultures around the world. You were going to describe whale hunt for us, please.
Yes. I suppose I started out with one hunter who was very helpful to me, and he took me out hunting a lot. And for a lot of time, I was just a passenger on the boat. And beluga whales are sort of 13, 14 feet in length. And the boats are just aluminium skiffs, sort of 15 to 17 feet, not much bigger than the whales. And I start out just as a passenger observing what was going on. And over time, I learned how to drive the boat, how to move the boat through the water, and learned how to with working alongside the hunter, helping the hunter to hunt the whale. And I did this on many, many occasions just in practice when there was never a whale around. Mm. And this summer, another friend of mine, another hunter, we decided we'd go it alone and we'd see if we could do it. So we did, and we're successful.
You caught a whale?
We caught a whale, yeah. Yes. And the hunter, I controlled the boat, and what you have to do as the driver of the boat is not watch the whale or the water or anything, but watch the hunter who's at the front of the boat with his wooden harpoon.
We're not talking kayaks anymore, are they? What size?
No, they're about 15, 17 feet long.
It's a traditional trawler,
aluminium,
like in the
aluminium skiffs, just
right,
a skiff with an outboard motor.
Fair enough.
Yeah, and there's very little. A lot of hunting culture is based around sign language and watching people's body movements and facial expressions and so on. And so through watching him, I knew how to move the boat, where to turn, when to slow down, when to speed up, turn right, turn left, put it in reverse, stuff like that. We got a big whale, and it was a thrilling, exhilarating experience. And we got back to town, and the hunter told it. I didn't tell anyone. He told everybody. And so, you know, I was sort of walking around town and people were patting me on the shoulder. Oh, you got your whale. And doubly so because I'm a woman and women don't go to sea and don't hunt whales. So it was
And as far as they were concerned, that whale gave itself up, that beluga gave itself up consciously to you.
Yes,
John,
and the hunter,
it's
yeah.
a phenomenal concept that. Have you come across that where, you know, you're working with a tribe and you suddenly realise that they're seeing the world in a completely different way from you?
For sure. I suppose one of the most radical examples that I've come across would be with these Siberian reindeer herders, and they eat virtually nothing but raw reindeer. And when I mean raw, I mean 30 seconds old raw. And for us sort of inured to eating meat out of plastic packages, it is quite a shock the first time you see it. Basically, they strangle the deer and they slit them open right in, you know, directly. Yeah. And steam billows out and they're straight in with the mugs to get the blood, which is very important to them for the nutrients they get out of it. In fact, and then they cut open the carcass, all of the blood gathers in the rib cage and they pour in a pile of salt. And then the whole family just dips in with these mugs and just gets covered in blood. I mean, it's quite a sight.
Have you tasted the meat? Have you drunk the blood?
Oh, for sure. If you're a visitor, you're there and you're given the tastiest bits first. And you're handed a handful of steaming liver and expected to dig in.
And do you manage? Is it okay?
There was a group of us there and some did and some didn't, in the sense that it was a crew. I did, yeah. And after a while, you get very used to it.
And to sum up, Martina, as you say, you've described, you've gone through experiences where sometimes you're left without caribou meat, you're left in dangers. Your husband, we've just had Christmas, your husband is down in the Antarctic, on the Antarctic ice sheet. You're not going to see him for what? He's going to be there for 4 months.
Yes.
You're putting yourself in these extreme positions at times. Are there some times where you suffer extreme doubts, where you wonder about this whole life you've carved out for yourself?
Never.
Really?
I absolutely love the life I have. I have a great life. I love travelling. There are some times when I think, do I really want to stay in the Arctic, or, you know, might I my next big adventure, I think, might be the South Pacific, but it could be a few years down the road. But no, I think my husband and I, you know, he works in Antarctica, I work in the Canadian Arctic. We don't see each other as often as we should, maybe, or as we would like. But it's a great life for both of us, and we both thoroughly enjoy it. And it's great that through our jobs, we get to go to places that we otherwise would ever get to see. You know, these are places that are incredibly expensive to visit. Mm. And I think, like John said earlier, to actually immerse yourself, or for me, to immerse myself in a culture, not just to go there as a tourist and spend a short time, but to actually get to know people, to learn a bit of the language, to eat the food in all its permutations. That's a fantastic thing. And I love that. But maybe somewhere warmer sometime soon.
That would make a lot of sense. John, you were just telling me that you're back from Nepal following a salt trek, a nomadic trip, Nepalese nomadic trip over the mountains following salt. And well, one of the lead people died on the first few days. At moments like that, do you not wonder? Do you not just worry about this situations you've got yourself into?
It does cross your mind. In this case, yes, one of the people we were following died very tragically and quickly in front of us. And, of course, immediately was, can we help him in the few minutes that we had before he actually died? And you realise you're 2 weeks from the nearest medical clinic. So, and you think, OK, that could have been me. Mm. And I'd be dead for sure if anything even relatively straightforward went wrong that would normally be sort of cured or looked after if you were in a city somewhere. But I think that passes, and you realise that that goes with the territory, that, you know, you take risks, and if something goes wrong, you just have to live with it.
Right.
Thanks for listening to the Big Adventure podcast, a Mixed Bag Media production for RTE.